that the early himself hadn't wanted skilled or believable acting to get in the way of the abstract ideas and technical innovations in the cartridges. And this had always seemed to me more like Brecht than like Bresson. Conceptual and technical ingenuity didn't much interest entertainment film audiences, though, and one way of looking at himself's abandonment of anti-confluentialism is that, in his last several projects, he'd been so desperate to make something that ordinary U.S. audiences might find entertaining and diverting and conducive to self-forgetting,
378,
that he had had professionals and amateurs alike emoting wildly all over the place. Getting emotion out of either actors or audiences had never struck me as one of himself's strengths, though I could remember arguments during which Mario had claimed I didn't see a lot of what was right there. Cosgrove Watt was a pro, but he wasn't very good. And before himself discovered him, Watt's career consisted mostly of regional market commercials on broadcast television. His widest commercial exposure was as the dancing gland in a series of spots for a chain of East Coast endocrinology clinics. He'd worn a bulbous white costume, white toupee, and either a ball and chain or white tap shoes, depending on whether he was portraying the before gland or the after gland. Himself, during one of these commercials, had shouted Eureka at our HD Sony and traveled personally all the way to Glen Riddle, Pennsylvania, where Watt lived with his mother and her cats, to recruit him. He used Cosgrove Watt in almost every project for 18 months. Watt, for a time, was to himself as De Niro was to Scorsese, McLaughlin to Lynch, Allen to Allen. And up until Watt's temporal lobe problem made his social presence unbearable, himself had actually put Watt, mother, and cats up in a contiguous suite of what later became prorector's rooms off the main ETA tunnel, the moms acquiescing in this, but instructing Oren, Mario, and me never, ever to remain in a room alone with Watt. Accomplice was one of Watt's later roles. It was a sad and simple cartridge, and so short that the TP retracted to the film's beginning in almost no time. Himself's film opens as a beautiful, sad, young bus station male prostitute, fragile and epicene, and so blonde even his eyebrows and lashes are blonde, is approached in the Greyhound coffee shop by a flabby, dissipated-looking old specimen, with gray teeth and circumflex eyebrows and obvious temporal lobe difficulties. Cosgrove Watt plays the depraved older man, who takes the boy home to his lush but somehow scuzzy co-op apartment, in fact, the place himself had rented for O and the PGOAT, and had decorated in various gradations of scuzz for the interiors of almost all his late projects. The sad and beautiful Aryan-looking boy agrees to seduction by the dissipated old specimen, but only on the condition that the man wear protection. The boy, who is inarticulate, nevertheless makes this stipulation extremely clear. Safe sex or no sex, he stipulates, holding up a familiar foil packet. The hideous old specimen, now in a smoking jacket and ascot of apricot-colored silk, and smoking through a long white FDR-style filter, is offended, thinks the young male prostitute has sized him up as such a depraved and dissipated old specimen that he might well have it, the human immunovirus, he thinks. His thoughts are rendered via animated thought bubbles, which himself, at that late middle stage, hoped the audience would find at once self-consciously non-illusory and wildly entertaining. Watt's old specimen is grinning grayly in what he thinks is a pleasant way, as he obligingly takes the foil packet and removes his ascot with what he believes to be a sensual flourish. But inside his thought bubble, he's having temporal lobe spasms of sadistic rage at the sad blonde boy for appearing to size him up as a health risk. The obvious health risk here is referred to, both orally and in the thought bubble, merely as it. For example, little bastard thinks I'm so dissipated-looking that I've been at this sort of thing so long that I'm likely to have it, does he? The old specimen thinks, his thought bubble going all jagged with rage. So the flabby old specimen's now, at only 6 minutes into the cartridge, track 510, he's now taking the sad, beautiful boy in the standard, extravagantly hunched, homosexual way, on the canopied bed of his tacky boudoir. The young male prostitutes dutifully assumed the hunched, homo-submissive position because the old Ponce has showed him he's wearing the condom. The young prostitute, who shone, hunched, only from the left side during the act itself, seems beautiful, in a fragile, skinny-flanked, visible ribs way, while the old specimen has the slack ass and pointy little breasts of a man made grotesque by years of dissipation. The intercourse scene is done under bright lamps without any sort of soft focus or light jazz background score to lighten the atmosphere of clinical detachment. What the sad blonde submissive boy doesn't know is that the dissipated old specimen had secretly palmed an old-fashioned, one sharp-sided razor blade when he'd gone into his burgundy-tiled bathroom to gargle with cinnamon mouthwash and dab Calvin Klein brand pheromonic musk on his flabby pulse points. And as he hunches animalistically over the boy, he's holding the business end of the blade right up next to the sad boy's anus as he takes his pleasure, so that the blade's sharp side slices into both condom and erect phallus on each outthrust. The hideous old specimen, unmindful of the blood and whatever pains involved in the phallic slicing as, still hunched and thrusting, he peels the slit condom off like the skin of a sausage. The young male prostitute, hunched submissively, feels the condom peel and then the blood and starts struggling like a condemned man, trying to get the condomless, bleeding, flabby old specimen out and off of him. But the boy's thin and delicate, and the old man has no trouble holding him down with his soft, slack, flabby weight until he's grimaced and grunted and taken his pleasure to its end. It's apparently an explicit homosexual sex scene convention that whoever takes the submissive hunched position keeps his face turned away from the camera while the dominant partner's phallus is inside him, and himself honors this convention, though a self-conscious footnote subtitled along the bottom of the screen rather irritatingly points out that the scene is honoring a convention. The prostitute turns his agonized face around to the camera only after the depraved older homosexual has removed his bloody and deflating post-pleasure phallus, brings his blonde, browed face around to his left to face the audience in a mute howl as he collapses onto his delicate chest with his arms out on the satin sheets and his violated bum hiked high in the air, revealing now, at the crease of his bum and upper hamstring, a vivid purple splotch, more vivid than any bruise, and with eight spidery tentacles radiating from it that are, the older man's horrified thought bubble reveals, the unmistakable, eight-legged vivid contusion blotch sign of Kaposi's sarcoma, that most universal symptom of it. And the boy is sobbing that the depraved old homosexual has made him, the prostitute, a murderer. The boy's racking sobs making the hiked bum waggle in front of the old specimen's horrified face, as the boy sobs into the chartreuse satin and shrieks, "Murderer! Murderer!" over and over, so that almost a third of accomplice's total length is devoted to the racked repetition of this word, way, way longer than is needed for the audience to absorb the twist and all its possible implications and meanings. This was just the sort of issue Mario and I argued about. As I see it, even though the cartridge's end has both characters emoting out of every pore, accomplice's essential project remains abstract and self-reflexive. We end up feeling and thinking not about the characters, but about the cartridge itself. By the time the final repetitive image darkens to a silhouette and the credits roll against it, and the old man's face stops spasming in horror, and the boy shuts up, the cartridge's real tension becomes the question, did himself subject us to 500 seconds of the repeated cry, "Murderer," for some reason? I.e., is the puzzlement, and then boredom, and then impatience, and then excruciation, and then near rage aroused in the film's audience by the static repetitive final one-third of the film, aroused for some theoretical aesthetic end? Or is himself simply an amazingly shitty editor of his own stuff? It was only after himself's death that critics and theorists started to treat this question as potentially important. A woman at UCal Irvine had earned tenure with an essay arguing that the reason versus no reason debate about what was unentertaining in himself's work illuminated the central conundrum of millennial après-garde film, most of which, in the telepeter age of home-only entertainment, involved the question, why so much aesthetically ambitious film was so boring, and why so much shitty reductive commercial entertainment was so much fun. The essay was turgid to the point of being unreadable, besides using reference as a verb and pluralizing conundrum as conundra.
379.
From a horizontal position on the bedroom floor, I could use the TP's remote to do everything but actually remove and insert cartridges into the drive's dock. The room's window was now a translucent clot of snow and steam. Interlace's spontaneous disseminations for New England were all about weather. With our subscription system, ETA got numerous large market spontaneous tracks. Each track took a slightly different angle on the weather. Each track had a slightly different focus. Remote reports from Boston's North and South Shores, Providence, New Haven, and Hartford, Springfield, served to establish a consensus that a terrific amount of snow had fallen and was continuing to fall and blow around and pile up. Cars were shown abandoned at hasty angles, and we got to see the universal white VW bug shape of snow-buried cars. Black-helmeted gangs of adolescents on snowmobiles were shown prowling New Haven streets, clearly up to no good. Pedestrians were shown bent over and floundering. Remote report journalists were shown trying to flounder over to them to get their thoughts and reflections. One floundering reporter in Quincy, on the South Shore, abruptly disappeared from view, except for a hand with a microphone protruding bravely from some sort of sinkhole of snow. The bent backs of technicians were then shown, floundering away from the remote camera to his aid. People with snowblowers stood in their own little blizzards. A pedestrian was filmed doing a spectacular pratfall. Cars at all angles and streets were shown with their tires spinning, shuddering in stasis. One track kept cutting back to a man endlessly trying to brush off a windshield that immediately whitened again behind each brushstroke. A bus sat with its snout in a monster-sized drift. ATH-SCME fans atop the wall north of Ticonderoga, New York, were shown making horizontal cyclones of snow in the air. Rouged, somber women in Interlace Studios concurred that this was the worst blizzard to hit the region since BS 1998, and the second worst since BS 1993. A man in a wheelchair was shown staring stonily at a 2-meter drift across the ramp outside the statehouse. Satellite maps of East Central ONAN showed a white formation that was spiraled and shaggy and seemed to have what looked like claws. It was not a nor'easter, a hot, moist ridge from the Gulf of Mexico, and an Arctic cold front had collided over the concavity. The storm's satellite photo was superimposed on schemata of the 98 ass kicker and shown to be just about identical. An unwelcome old acquaintance was back, a striking woman with black bangs and vivid lipstick said, smiling somberly. Another track iterated, this was not a nor'easter. It might have been better to say, smiling mirthlessly. The flat, glazed eyes of the man brushing impotently at his windshield seemed to represent an important visual image. Different tracks kept returning to his face. He refused to acknowledge journalists or requests for thoughts. His was the creepy businesslike face of someone carefully picking up glass in the road after an accident in which his decapitated wife's been impaled on the steering wheel. Another track's anchor was a beautiful black woman with purple lipstick and what looked like a very tall crew cut. Reports of snow came in from all directions. After a while, I stopped keeping track of the number of times the word snow was repeated. All synonyms for snowstorm were rapidly exhausted. Helmetless thrill-seekers on snowmobiles were doing donuts in Copley Square downtown. Homeless men hunched, nearly drift-covered in doorways, readying snorkels of rolled-up newspaper. Jim Trolch, now apparently a resident of B204, had liked to do a pretty funny impression of an Interlace anchorwoman having an orgasm. One of the thrill-seekers' snowmobiles spun out of control and plunged into a drift, and the remote camera stayed on the drift for several moments, but nothing emerged. Connecticut's National Guard Reserve had been ordered to assemble, but had not assembled because travel in Connecticut was impossible. Three men in uniforms and gray helmets chased two men in white helmets, all on snowmobiles, for reasons an on-site journalist described as not yet emergent. Remote site journalists used such words as emergent, individual, alleged, utilize, and developing. But all this impersonal diction was preceded by the anchor person's first name, as if the report were part of an intimate conversation. An interlaced delivery boy was shown delivering recorded cartridges on a snowmobile and was described as plucky. Otis P. Lord had undergone a procedure for the removal of the Hitachi monitor on Thursday, Lamont Shue had said. I had never once ridden a snowmobile, skied or skated. ETA discouraged them. DeLint described winter sports as practically getting down on one knee and begging for an injury. The snowmobiles on the viewer all made sounds like little chainsaws that were extra pugnacious to compensate for being so little. There was a poignant shot of a stuck plow in Northampton. Individuals who are not with emergency reasons to travel, sick, were being officially discouraged from traveling by a state trooper in a hat with a chin strap. A Brockton man in a Land's End parka took a fall too burlesque to have been unstaged. I could barely recall the 98 blizzard. The academy had been open for only a few months. I remember the edges of the shaved hilltop were still square and steep and striped in sedimentary layers, final construction delayed by some nasty piece of litigation from the VA hospital below. The storm came barreling in southeast from Canada in March. Dwight, Flechette, and Oren, and the other players, had to be led to the lung, roped together, single file, Stitt in the lead, carrying a highway flare. A couple photos hung in CT's waiting room. The last boy along the rope disappeared into a forlorn gray whirl. The lung's new bubble had to be taken down and fixed when Snow White stove it in on one side. The T stopped running. I remember some of the younger players had cried and sworn up and down that the blizzard wasn't their fault. For days, snow churned steadily out of a graphite sky. Himself had sat in a spindle-backed chair at the same living room window CT now uses for advanced worry, and aimed a series of non-digital cameras at the mounting snow. After years in which his consuming obsession was the establishment of ETA, Oren said, himself had started in with the film obsession almost immediately after the Academy was up and running. Oren has said the moms had assumed the film thing was a passing obsession. Himself had seemed interested mostly in the lenses and rasters at first.
380.
And in the consequences of their modification. He sat in that chair throughout the whole storm, sipping brandy from a one-handed snifter, his long legs not quite covered by a plaid blanket. His legs had seemed to me almost endlessly long back then. He always seemed to be right on the edge of coming down with something. His record, up until then, indicated that he remained obsessed with something until he became successful at it, then transferred his obsession to something else. From military optics, to annular optics, to entrepreneurial optics, to tennis pedagogy, to film. In the chair during the blizzard, he'd had beside him several different types of camera and a large leather case. The inside of the case was striated with lenses down both sides. He used to let Mario and me put different lenses in our eyes and squint to hold them, imitating Stitt. One way of looking at the film obsession's endurance is that himself was never really successful or accomplished at filmmaking. This was something else on which Mario and I had agreed to disagree. It took almost a year to complete the move from Weston to ETA. The moms had attachments in Weston, and she drew things out. I was pretty small. I lay flat on my back on our room's carpet and tried to recall details of our home in Weston, twiddling the TP's remote with my thumb. I do not have Mario's head for remembered detail. One dissemination track simply panned the metro Boston sky and horizons from atop the Hancock Tower. On the FM band, WYYY was apparently doing its weather report via mimesis, broadcasting raw static, while the student staff doubtless did bongs in celebration of the storm, and then went up, sliding around the Union's cerebral rooftop. The Hancock camera's pan included the sinciput of the MIT Union, its roofs, convolutions filling the snow ahead of the rest of it, creepy filigrees of white against the roof's deep gray. Our subdorm room's only carpet was an oversized corruption of the carpet page from the Lindisfarne Gospels, in which you had to look very closely to make out the tiny pornographic scenes in the Byzantine weave surrounding the cross. I'd acquired the carpet years ago, during a period of intense interest in Byzantine pornography, inspired by what I'd seen as a titillating reference in the OED. I, too, had moved serially between obsessions as a child. I adjusted my angle on the carpet. I was trying to align myself along some sort of grain in the world I could barely feel since Pemulus and I stopped. Meaning the grain, not the world. I realized I could not distinguish my own visual memories of the Weston house from my memories of hearing Mario's detailed reports of his memories. I remember a late Victorian three-level on a low quiet street of elms, hyper-fertilized lawns, tall homes with oval windows and screen porches. One of the street's homes had a pineapple finial. Only the street itself was low. The lots were humped up high and the houses so tall, the broad street seemed nevertheless constricted, a sort of affluence-flanked defile. It seemed always to be summer or spring. I could remember the mom's voice high overhead at a screen porch door, calling us in as dusk drifted down, and leaded fanlights began to light up at home's doors in some sort of linear sink. Either our driveway or another driveway, flanked with whitewashed stones the shapes of beads or drops. The mom's intricate garden, in a backyard enclosed by a fencework of trees. Himself on the screen porch, stirring a gin and tonic with his finger. The mom's dog, S. Johnson, not yet neutered, confined by psychosis in a sort of large fenced pen abutting the garage, running around and around the pen when thunder sounded. The smell of Noxzema. Himself behind Orin in the upstairs bathroom, towering over and down, teaching Orin to shave against the grain, upward. I remember S. Johnson leaping up on his hind legs and sort of playing the fence with his paws as Mario approached the pen. The rattling chain link's pitch. The circle of earth worn bare by SJ's orbit in the pen, when thunder sounded or planes crossed overhead. Himself sat low in chairs and could cross his legs and still have both feet flat on the floor. He held his chin in his hand while he looked at you. My memories of Weston seemed like tableaus. They seemed more like snapshots than films. A weird isolated memory of summertime gnats knitting the air above the shaggy animal head of a neighbor's topiary hedge. Our own round shrubs trimmed flat as tabletops by the moms. More horizontals. The chatter of hedge clippers, their power cords bright orange. I had to swallow spit with almost every breath. I remembered climbing with a dawdler's heavy tread, the cement steps up from the street to a gambrel-roofed late Victorian, whose narrow height from the steps gave it the distended look of thick liquid hanging. Gingerbread eaves, undulate shingles of weathered red, zinc gutters the moms' graduate students came and kept clean. A blue star in the front window and the words Block Mother, which had always suggested either a rectangular woman or some type of football crowd cheer. The inside cool and dim, and a smell of lemon pledge. I had no visual memories of my mother without white hair. All that varied was the length. A touchtone phone with a cord running into the wall, on a horizontal surface, in a recessed alcove near the front door. Cork floors and pre-mounted shelving of woody-smelling wood. The chilling frame print of Lang directing Metropolis in 1924.
381.
a hulking black chest with strap hinges of brass. A few of himself sold heavy tennis trophies as bookends on the mounted shelving. An etagere filled with old-fashioned magnetic videos and bright adverting boxes, a cluster of blue and white Delfts on the etagere's top shelf that had dwindled as one figurine after another got knocked off by Mario, stumbling or shoved. The blue-white chairs with the protective plastic that made your legs sweat. A divan done in some sort of burlap-esque Iranian wool dyed to the color of sand mixed with ash. This may have been a neighbor's divan. Some cigarette burns in the fabric of the divan's arms. Books, videotapes, kitchen cans, all alphabetized. Everything painfully clean. Several spindle-backed captain's chairs in contrasting fruit woods. A surreal memory of a steamed lavatory mirror with a knife sticking out of the pane. A massive stereo television console, of whose gray-green eye I was afraid when the television was off. Some of the memories have to be confabulated or dreamed. The moms would never have had a divan with burns in it. A picture window east, the direction of Boston, with claret-colored figures, and a blue sun all suspended in a web of lead. The candy-colored summer sunrise through that window as I watched television in the AM. The tall, thin, quiet man, himself, with his razor burn and bent glasses and chinos too short, whose neck was slender and shoulders sloped, who slumped in candied east window sunlight, with his tailbone supported by window sills, meekly stirring a glass of something with his finger, while the mom stood there telling him she'd long since abandoned any reasonable hope that he could hear what she was telling him. This silent figure, of whom I still remember mostly endless legs and the smell of Noxzema shave cream, seems still impossible to reconcile with the sensibility of something like accomplice. It was impossible to imagine himself conceiving of sodomy and razors, no matter how theoretically. I lay there and could almost remember Oren telling me something almost moving that himself had once told him. Something to do with accomplice. The memory hung somewhere just out of conscious reach, and its tip-of-the-tongue inaccessibility felt too much like the preface to another attack. I accepted it. I could not remember. Off down the Weston Street, a church with an announcement board in the grass out front, white plastic letters on a slotted black surface. And at least once, Mario and I stood watching a goatish man change the letters, and thus the announcement. One of the first occasions where I remember reading something involved the announcement board announcing, "Life is like tennis. Those who serve best usually win," with the letters all spaced far out like that. A big, fresh, cement-colored church, liberal with glass, denomination not recalled, but built in what was, in the BS 80s probably, modern. A parabolic, poured concrete shape, billowed and peaked like a cresting wave. A suggestion in it of some paranormal wind somewhere that could make concrete billow and pop like a tucking sail. Our own sub-dorm room now has three of those old Weston captain's chairs whose backs dent your spine if you don't fit it carefully between two spindles. We have an unused wicker basket for laundry on which are stacked some corduroy spectation pillows. Floor plans for Hagia Sophia and St. Simeon at Kalat Siman on the wall over my bed. The really prurient part of consummation of the leverets over the chairs, also from the old interest in Byzantinalia. Something about the stiff and dismantled quality of many era Greca porn, people broken into pieces and trying to join, etc. At the foot of Mario's bed, a surplus store trunk for his own film equipment, and a canvas director's chair where he's always laid out his police lock, lead weights, and vest for the night. A fiberboard stand for the compact TP and viewer, and a stenographer's chair for using the TP to type. Five total chairs in a room where no one ever sits in a chair. As in all the sub-dorm rooms and hallways, a guilloche ran around our walls half a meter from the ceiling. New ETAs always drove themselves bats, counting their rooms' guilloches interwoven circles. Our room had 811, and truncated bits of 12 and 13, two left halves stuck like open parentheses up in the southwest corner. Between the ages of 11 and 13, I'd had a plaster knockoff of a lewd Constantine Frieze. The emperor with a hyperemic organ and an impure expression hung by two hooks from the Geosha's lower border. Now I couldn't for the life of me recall what I'd done with the frieze, or which Byzantine seraglio the original had decorated. There had been a time when data like these were instantly available. The Weston living room had had an early version of himself's full-spectrum cove lighting, and at one end an elevated fieldstone fireplace with a big copper hood that made a wonderful ear-splitting drumhead for wooden spoons, with memories of some foreign adult I didn't recognize grinding at her temples and pleading, "Do stop." The mom's jungle of green babies had spread out into the room from another corner. The plants, pots, on stands of various heights, hanging in nests of twine suspended from clamps, arrayed at eye height from projecting trellises of white-painted iron, all in the otherworldly glow of a white-hooded tube of ultraviolet light hung with thin chains from the ceiling. Mario can recall violet-lit laces of ferns and the wet, meaty gloss of rubber tree leaves, and a coffee table of green-shot black marble, too heavy to move, on whose corner Mario knocked out a tooth after what Oren swore up and down was an accidental shove. Mrs. Clark's variocotic calves at the stove, the way her mouth overhead would disappear when the moms reorganized something in the kitchen. My eating mold, and the moms' being very upset that I'd eaten it. This memory was of Oren's telling the story. I had no childhood memory of eating fungus. My trusty NASA glass still rested on my chest, rising when my ribcage rose. When I looked down my own length, the glass's round mouth was a narrow slot. This was because of my optical perspective. There was a concise term for optical perspective that I, again, could not quite make resolve. What made it hard really to recall our old house's living room was that so many of its appointments were now in the living room of the headmaster's house, the same and yet altered, and by more than rearrangement. The onyx coffee table Mario had fallen against. Specular is what refers to optical perspective. It came to me after I stopped trying to recall it. Now supported compact discs and tennis magazines and a cello-shaped vase of dried eucalyptus, and the red steel stand for the family Xmas tree when in season. The table had been a wedding gift from himself's mother, who died of emphysema shortly before Mario's surprise birth. Oren reports she'd looked like an embalmed poodle, all neck tendons and tight white curls and eyes that were all pupil. The mom's birth mother had died in Quebec of an infarction when she, the mom's, was 8. Her father, during her sophomore year at McGill under circumstances none of us knew. The hydrant-sized Mrs. Tavis was still alive and somewhere in Alberta, the original Lillet potato farm now part of the Great Concavity and forever lost. Oren and Bain, among others, at family trivia during that terrible first year's blizzard, Oren imitating the mom's high breathy, "My son ate this, God, please," never tiring of it. Oren had liked also to recreate for us the spooky, kyphotic hunch of himself's mother in her wheelchair, beckoning him closer with a claw, the way she seemed always caved in, over and around her chest, as if she'd been speared there. An air of deep dehydration had hung about her, he said, as if she osmosized moisture from whoever came near. She spent her last few years living in the Marlborough Street brownstone they'd had before Mario and I were born, tended by a gerontologic nurse, Oren said, always wore the expression of every post office mugshot you've ever seen. When the nurse was off, a small silver bell was apparently hung from an arm of the old lady's wheelchair, to be rung when she could not breathe. A cherry silver tinkle announcing asphyxiation upstairs. Mrs. Clark would still pale whenever Mario asked about her. It's become easier to see the climacteric changes in the mom's own body, since she began confining herself more and more to the headmaster's house. This occurred after himself's funeral, but in stages. The gradual withdrawal, and reluctance to leave the grounds, and the signs of aging. It is hard to notice what you see every day. None of the physical changes has been dramatic. her nerved-up dancer's legs becoming hard, stringy, a shrinking of the hips and a girdly thickening at the waist. Her face settles a little lower on her skull than it did 4 years ago, with a slight bunching under the chin and an emerging potential for something pruny happening around her mouth. In time, I thought I could see. The word that best connoted why the glass's mouth looked slotty was probably foreshortened. The QRS infantilist would no doubt join the old grief therapist in asking how watching one's moms begin to age makes you feel inside. Questions like these become almost koans. You have to lie when the truth is nothing at all, since this appears as a textbook lie under the therapeutic model. The brutal questions are the ones that force you to lie. Either our old kitchen or a neighbor's kitchen, paneled with walnut and hung with copper pate molds and herbal sprigs. An unidentified woman, not Avril or Mrs. Clark, standing in that kitchen in snug cherry slacks, loafers over bare feet, waggling a mixing spoon, laughing at something, a long-tailed comet of flour on her cheek. It occurred to me then, with some force, that I didn't want to play this afternoon, even if some sort of indoor exhibition meet came off. Not even neutral, I realized, I would, on the whole, have preferred not to play. What Stitt might have to say to that versus what Lyle would say? I wasn't able to stay with the thought long enough to imagine himself's response to my refusal to play, if any. But this was the man who made Accomplice, whose sensibility informed the hetero-hardcore Mobius strips and the sado-periodontal Fun with Teeth and several other projects that were just thoroughgoingly nasty and sick. Then it occurred to me that I could walk outside and contrive to take a spill, or squeeze out the window on the rear staircase of HMH and fall several meters to the steep embankment below, being sure to land on the bad ankle and hurt it so I'd not have to play. That I could carefully plan out a fall from the court's observation transom or the spectators' gallery of whatever club CT and the moms sent us to help raise funds, and fall so carefully, badly, I'd take out all the ankle's ligaments and never play again. Never have to. Never get to. I could be the faultless victim of a freak accident and be knocked from the game while still on the ascendant, becoming the object of compassionate sorrow rather than disappointed sorrow. I couldn't stay with this fantastic line of thought long enough to parse out whose disappointment I was willing to cripple myself to avoid or forego. And then, out of nowhere, it returned to me. The moving thing himself had said to Oren. This was concerning adult films, which, from what I've seen, are too downright sad to be truly nasty, or even really entertainment, though the adjective adult is kind of a misnomer. Oren had told me that once he and Smothergill, Fletchett, and I think Penn's older brother had gotten hold of a magnetic video of some old hardcore X film, The Green Door or Deep Throat, one of those old chestnuts of cellulite and jism. There were excited plans to convene in VR3 and watch the thing in secret after lights out. The viewing rooms at that point had broadcast televisions and magnetic VCR devices, instructional magvids from Galloway and Braden, etc. Oren and company were all around 15 at the time, bombed by their own glands. They were pop-eyed at the prospect of genuine porn. There were rules about video's suitability for viewing in the honor code, but himself was not noted for his discipline, and Stitt didn't yet have Delint. The first generation of ETAs did pretty much as they pleased off-court, as long as they were discreet. Nevertheless, word about this adult film got around, and somebody, probably Mary Esther Thode's sister Ruth, then a senior and insufferable, ratted the boys' viewing plans out to Stitt, who took the matter to himself. Oren said he was the only one himself called into the headmaster's office, which, in that era, had only one door, which himself asked Oren to close. Oren recalled seeing none of the unease that always accompanied himself's attempts at stern discipline. Instead, himself invited Oren to sit and gave him a lemon soda and stood facing him, leaning back slightly so that the front edge of his desk supported him at the tailbone. Himself took his glasses off and massaged his closed eyes delicately. almost treasuringly, his old eyeballs, in the way Orin knew signified that himself was ruminative and sad. One or two soft interrogatives brought the whole affair out in the open. You could never lie to himself. Somehow you just never had the heart. Whereas Orin made almost an Olympic sport of lying to the moms. Anyway, Orin quickly confessed to everything. What himself said then moved him, Orin told me. Himself told Orin he wasn't going to forbid them to watch the thing if they really wanted to, but just, please, to keep it discreet. Just Bane and Smothergill in Orin's immediate circle, nobody younger, and nobody whose parents might hear about it. And for God's sake, don't let your mother get wind. But that Orin was old enough to make his own entertainment decisions, and if he decided he wanted to watch the thing, and so on. But himself said that if Orin wanted his personal fatherly, as opposed to headmasterly, take on it, then he, Orin's father, though he wouldn't forbid it, would rather Orin didn't watch a hard porn film yet. He said this with such reticent earnestness. There was no way Orin couldn't ask him how come. Himself felt his jaw and pushed his glasses up several times and shrugged and finally said he supposed he was afraid of the film giving Orin the wrong idea about having sex. He said he'd personally prefer that Orin wait until he'd found someone he loved enough to want to have sex with and had had sex with this person, that he'd wait until he'd experienced for himself what a profound and really quite moving thing sex could be before he watched a film where sex was presented as nothing more than organs going in and out of other organs, emotionless, terribly lonely. He said he supposed he was afraid that something like The Green Door would give Orin an impoverished, lonely idea of sexuality. What poor old O claimed to have found so moving was himself's assumption that O was still chary. What moved me to feel sorry for Orin was that it seemed pretty obvious that that had nothing to do with what himself was trying to talk about. It was the most open I'd ever heard of himself being with anybody, and it seemed terribly sad to me somehow that he'd wasted it on Orin. I never once had a conversation nearly that open or intimate with himself. My most intimate memory of himself was the scratchiness of his jaw and the smell of his neck when I fell asleep at supper and he carried me upstairs to bed. His neck was thin but had a good meaty warm smell. I now for some reason associate it with the odor of Coach Stitt's pipe. I tried, briefly, to picture Ortho Stice hoisting his bunk up and bolting it to the ceiling without waking Coil. Our room's door remained ajar from Mario's exit with Coil to find someone with a master key. Yard Guard and Vaganecht's heads popped in briefly and urged me to come have a look at the darkness's ruined map and withdrew when they got no response. The second floor was pretty quiet. Most of them were still dawdling at breakfast, awaiting some announcement on the weather and Quebecois squads. Snow hit the windows with a gritty sound. The angle of the wind had made a kind of whistle out of one corner of the subdorm building, and the whistling came and went. But then I heard John Wayne stride in the hall outside, light and even and easy on floors, the stride of a guy with stellar calf development. I heard his low sigh. Then, though the door was too far behind me to see, for a moment or two, I could somehow tell for sure that John Wayne's head was inside the open door. I could feel it, clearly, almost painfully. He was looking down at me, lying there on the Lindisfarne carpet. There was none of the gathering tension of a person deciding whether or not to speak. I could feel my throat's equipment move when I swallowed. John Wayne and I never had much to say to one another. There wasn't even hostility between us. He ate dinner with us at HMH every so often because he and the moms were tight. The moms made little attempt to disguise her attachment to Wayne. Now his breathing behind me was light and very even. No waste. Complete utilization of each breath.
382.
Of us three, it was Mario who had spent the most time with himself, sometimes traveling with him for location work. I had no idea what they spoke about together, or how openly. None of us had ever pressed Mario to say much about it. It occurred to me to wonder why this was so. I decided to get up, but then did not, in fact, get up. Oren was convinced that himself was a virgin when he met the moms in his late 30s. I found this pretty hard to believe. Oren will also grant that there's no doubt himself was faithful to the moms right up to the end, that his attachment to Oren's fiancée was not sexual. I had a sudden and lucid vision of the moms and John Wayne locked in a sexual embrace of some kind. John Wayne had been involved with the moms sexually since roughly the second month after his arrival. They were both expatriates. I hadn't yet been able to identify a strong feeling, one way or the other, about the liaison, nor about Wayne himself, except for admiring his talent and total focus. I did not know whether Mario knew of the liaison, to say nothing of poor C.T. It was impossible for me to imagine himself and the moms being explicitly sexual together. I bet most children have this difficulty, where their parents are concerned. Sex between the moms and C.T., I imagined as both frenetic and weary, with a kind of doomed, timeless, Faulknerian feel to it. I imagined the moms' eyes open and staring blankly at the ceiling the whole time. I imagined C.T. never once shutting up, talking around and around whatever was taking place between them. My coccyx had gone numb from the pressure of the floor through the thin carpet. Bane, graduate students, grammatical colleagues, Japanese fight choreographers, the hairy-shouldered Ken N. Johnson, the Islamic M.D. himself had found so especially torturing, these encounters were imaginable, but somehow generic. Mostly a matter of athleticism and flexibility, different configurations of limbs, the mood one more of cooperation than complicity or passion. I tended to imagine the moms staring expressionlessly at ceilings throughout. The complicit passion would have come after, probably, with her need to be sure the encounter was hidden. Peterson allusions notwithstanding, I wondered about some hazy connection between this passion for hiddenness and the fact that himself had made so many films titled Cage, and that the amateur player he became so attached to was the veiled girl, Oren's love. I wondered whether it was possible to lie supine and throw up without aspirating vomit or choking. The plumed spout of a whale. The tableau of John Wayne and my mother in my imagination was not very erotic. The image was complete and sharply focused, but seemed stilted, as if composed. She reclines against four pillows at an angle between seated and supine, staring upward, motionless and pale. Wayne, slim and brown-limbed, smoothly muscled, also completely motionless, lies over her, his untanned bottom in the air, his blank, narrow face between her breasts, his eyes unblinking and his thin tongue outthrust like a stunned lizard's. They stay just like that. She wasn't dumb. She figured it was likely that they'd let her loose just to see where she'd go. She went home. She went to the house. She got one of the last trains before they closed the T, probably. It took forever to get from Com Ave down to Enfield Marine in her clogs and skirt in the snow, and melt soaked the veil and made it adhere to the features below. She'd been close to removing the veil to get away from the outside linebacker of a federal lady anyway. She looked now just like a linen-pale version of what she really looked like. But there was no one about in the snow. She figured if she could speak with Pat M., Pat M. might be prevailed upon to put her in quarantine with Glenette and Yolanda, not let in no law. She could tell Pat about the wheelchairs, try to convince her to dismantle the ramp. The visibility was so bad she didn't see it till she cleared the shed, the Middlesex County Sheriff's car, fiercely snow-tired, lights going bluely, parked, idling in the roadlet outside the ramp, wipers on occasional, a uniform at the wheel, absently feeling his face. He says, I'm Mikey, alcoholic, an addict, and a sick fuck, you know what I'm saying? And they laugh and shout out, You definitely are, as he stands there rocking the podium slightly, blurred a bit through the linen, smearing one side of his face with a laborer's hand as he tries to think what to say. It's another of these round-robin speaker deals, each speaker picking the next from the smoky lunchtime crowd, jogging up to the fiberboard podium, trying to think what to say and how, for the 5 minutes each is allotted. The chairperson at the table, up by the podium, has a clock and a novelty shop gong.
Well, so, I seen some of the old Mikey come back out yesterday, you know what I'm saying? Fucking scared me to see it. What it was, I was gonna take my kid down to the lanes and bowl a couple, with my kid, who, he just got the cast off. So I'm all happy and whatnot, got the day off, see the kid, quality sober time with the kid, so on and so forth. So, I'm all on the happy wagon and like that, about seeing the kid, you know what I'm saying? So, I call up my cunt of a sister. He's living back with him, with Ma, my sister. So I'm calling up my sister to see, can I come get the kid at such and such time and whatnot? Because you know how the judge said I gotta get one of them's fucking consent to even see my kid, you know what I'm saying? Because of the restraining order on the old Mikey from before, I gotta get their permission. And I say, okay, so I'm calling up, all accepting and on the happy wagon for my sister to consent, and she, out of the goodness of her heart, she makes me wait while she says she's got to check it with Ma. And they consent, finally, and I accept that. You know what I'm saying? And I say I was going to be there at such and such time and whatnot, and my sister says, ain't I even going to say thank you? Like with the attitude, you know what I'm saying? And I say, the fuck, what? You want a fucking medal for letting me see my own kid? And the cunt hangs up on me. Oh, ever since the judge with the order, it's with the attitude over there, the cunt and Ma both. So after she just hangs up on me, a little of the old Mikey, I think, starts to come out. And I go over there and, yes, all right, I gotta be honest, I do. I park on the grass of their fucking lawn and I go up and I see her and I'm like, fuck you, you cunt. And Ma's in the hall behind her in the door. I go, fucking hang up on me, why don't you? You should go for some fucking counseling, you know what I'm saying? And they don't neither of them like that verbal comment too much, right? The cunt almost starts laughing and goes like, I'm telling her to go for counseling.
Crowd laughter.
I mean, I ain't exactly coming over there with long-term sobriety, right? And I accept that. But the cunt's got the hook on the door and she's going, who the fuck are you to be telling me to go for fucking counseling? After the sick fucking little, like, stunt you and that bimbo pulled on that kid, who only just now even got the cast off. Oh, and no sign of the fucking kid anywhere. Just her and Ma through the screen door all over the place with the attitude. And now they tell me to get the fuck off their porch. No, they tell me, as in, like, permission denied. Consent to see my own fucking kid refused. And the cunt still in her fucking bathrobe after noon. And Ma behind her, half in the bag already, and hanging onto the fucking wall. You know what I'm saying? My serenity's like, see ya. And I say, up both of yous asses. I'm here for my goddamn kid. And now, my sister says she's going for the phone. And Ma's saying, the fuck, get the fuck out, Mikey. And plus, did I mention no sign of the kid? And I ain't to even, like, touch the screen door, not without consent. And I'm wanting to fucking kill somebody here, you know what I'm saying? And my sister's getting the antenna out of the phone, and so I go, okay, I'm fucking leaving. But I, like, grab my balls at the both of them and go, eat me, the both of yous. You know what I'm saying? Because now it's the old Mikey back. And now I got with the attitude now also. I'm wanting to light my cunt of a sister up so bad I can't hardly see to get the truck off the lawn and leave. But I'm driving back home. And I'm so mad, I all of a sudden try and pray. And I try and pray, driving along and whatnot, and it comes to me. I see, irregarding of their fucked up attitude, I still need to go back and apologize, irregardless, for grabbing my balls at them, because that's old fucking behavior. I see, for my own sobriety's sake, I need to go back and try and say I'm sorry. The thought of it just about makes me puke, you know what I'm... But I go back, and pull the truck up out front on the street and pray and go back up on the porch and I fucking apologize. And I go to my sister, please, can I at least see the kid to see the cast off? And the cunt goes, fuck you, get the fuck out. We don't accept your fucking apology. And no sign of Ma and the fucking kid, there's no sign of him. So I gotta accept her word and don't even know for sure if the cast is even off. But why I needed to share, I think, is it scared me. I scared me, you know what I'm saying? I was at the counselor's after, and I told him, I go, I gotta get some kind of hold on this fucking temper. I'm gonna end up right back in front of the fucking judge for lighting somebody up again, you know what I'm saying? And God fucking forbid it should be somebody that's in my family, because I've been that route once too many times already. And I go, like, am I nuts, Doc, or what? Do I got a, like, death wish or what? You know what I'm saying? The cash just only now finally comes off, and I'm wanting to light up the fucking cunt that's got the consent I should get closer than 100 meters to the kid. Is it like I'm trying to set myself up for a drink, or what exactly is it with this spring-loaded temper if I'm sober? The temper and judge is why I fucking got sober in the first place. So what the fuck is this? Well, fuck me. I'm just grateful I got some of that out. It's been up in my head, renting space, you know what I'm saying? I see Vinny's getting ready to fucking gong me, yeah. I want to hear from Tommy E. back there against the wall. Yo, Tommy! What are you, smacking a hog back there or what? But I'm just, glad to be here. I just wanted to get some of that shit out. The man's pants crease was gone at the knee, and his cardan topcoat looked slept in.
It was good of you to grant me an easement.
Pat M. tried to recross her legs and shrugged.
You said you weren't here professionally.
Good of you to believe me.
The assistant district attorney for Suffolk County's Fourth Circuit, up on the near North Shore's hat, was a good-dressed Stetson with a feather in the band. He held it up in his lap by the brim and slowly rotated it by moving his fingers along the brim. He'd recrossed his legs twice.
We met, you and Mars, at the Marblehead Regatta, for the McDonald's House thing for children. Not this summer, but either the summer.
I know who you are.
Pat's husband wasn't a celebrity, but knew a lot of local celebrities, from the mint-reconditioned sports car upscale network around Boston.
Well, it's good of you. I'm here about one of your residents.
But not professionally,
Pat said. It wasn't a question or verification. She was cool steel when it came to protecting the residence and house. Then back home, in her own home, she was a shattered husk of a wreck.
Frankly, I'm not sure why I am here. You're just down the hill from the hospital. I've been up at St. Elizabeth's off and on for 3 days. Perhaps I need to simply air this. The 5th District boys, the PDs, speak well of the place. Your house here. Perhaps I need simply to share this, to work up the nerve. My sponsor's no help. He simply said do it if you want to have any hope of things getting better.
Anything less than a combination thoroughgoing professional and AA longtimer would have at least hiked an eyebrow at one of the most powerful and remorseless constables in 3 counties, saying sponsor.
It's phobe comp anon, the ADA said. I went through choices last winter and have been working a program of recovery and
383.
Phobe comp anon, a day at a time, to the best of my ability, ever since then.
I see.
It's, Tootie, the ADA said.
He did a pause with his eyes closed and then smiled, still with his eyes closed.
It is rather me and my enmeshment issues with Tootie's condition.
Phobe Comp Anon was a decade-old 12-step splinter from Al Anon for codependency issues surrounding loved ones who were cripplingly phobic or compulsive, or both.
It's a long story and not a particularly interesting one, I'm sure,
the ADA said.
Suffice to say that Tootie's been in torment over some oral dental hygienic violation issues that have their roots, we're discovering, in some issues from a childhood whose dysfunctionality we